Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everyone. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Thank you very much, everybody, who's either joining us live or listening to us on the podcast. We appreciate you taking time today to join us and our guest and talk about the things that at least we find interesting. And if you're with that esteemed cohort that's with us live, if you scroll to the bottom of the show page, that's where you'll find a link to the chat room. If you have some observations you'd like to share during the course of the show, or if there are questions that you would like for us to direct to our guests, that's a great place to share it. We'll be monitoring it as the show goes forward. And if you have to take off and take care of some business, you can always catch what you missed by getting the full archive from Blog Talk Radio, or take the shortcut and go over to iTunes or Stitcher or one of the other podcast aggregators and subscribe to the Midrats podcast. But let's go ahead and roll in with the show today. When we look back into the last quarter of the 19th century, as we call the Gilded Age, it really was a period of breathtaking change, not just in technology, but in society, politics, industry, entire cultures. And the rapid change that was taking place inside the nation and the world was also reflected in our Navy, both intellectually and institutionally, that brought that Navy to the world's attention when we really broke onto the stage after the Spanish-American War of 1898. And in many things, when you look at World War I and another area of great change in the 1920s during the progressive era, a lot of people don't realize that the seed was planted and the ground prepared for the advances of the progressive era back in the Gilded Age at the last quarter of the 19th century. And our guest today for the full hour to discuss these and related issues, which he raises in his book, Progressives in the Navy Blue, Maritime Strategy, American Empire, and the Transformation of the U.S. Naval Identity, 1873 to 1898, will be Scott Mobley, Ph.D., Captain, United States Navy, retired. Scott is currently the Associate Director of the Center for the Study of Liberal Democracy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Scott, welcome to Midrats.
Well, Sal, thanks for having me. Thanks for inviting me to appear on the show. I'm happy to be here.
I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about what really is an interesting period of time, because for a lot of people who either just know of American history or naval history from what they may have studied in high school or college, or even some naval professionals who don't dig in it too deep, you have the great battle of the CSS Virginia versus the USS Monitor and Hampton Roads. Then you blink your eyes, and lo and behold, there's Admiral Dewey going into Manila Bay. But there was this huge period that you cover in your book from the post-Civil War period up to the Spanish-American War that really is a remarkable story. And if you could, as a scene setter, talk for a bit about what draw you to that period from how your book covers from 1873 to 1898, and what are some of the surprising things a listener not familiar with the area may find out?
Well, as far as what drew me to write the book, I think that my naval experience and my PhD studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison were probably the most formative in bringing that about. Once I retired from the Navy and actually had time to think at Wisconsin, I began to ask questions about the modern naval culture and why it's so distinctly different from what I was seeing in the past. So those questions instigated several smaller research projects that looked at the U.S. Navy's cultural and intellectual roots, and that later coalesced into my dissertation, which is what the book began as. It was my dissertation. One of the surprises that for me was, at least, that the idea of the professional culture of the Navy prior to this period we're talking about, prior to the Gilded Age and into the Gilded Age, which was really what I call a mariner warrior culture. And what defined an officer professionally was really seamanship skills, navigation skills, maybe some basic gunnery, handling a battery and that sort of thing, a very tactically oriented, and very much looking at, you know, the mariner side of things, which contrasted so drastically from what I experienced in my naval career. I spent 30 years as a nuclear qualified SWO. And when I compared the differences between my experience and my contemporaries' experiences and those of the 19th century naval officers, I became interested in how the profession appeared to change so sharply around 1900, a little bit before 1900. And then I read Mark Hagerot wrote his dissertation on basically similar types of questions in the 20th century, a little bit later. And so I read his dissertation, and that really piqued my interest. So, Mark talks about the generalist versus the technocrat in terms of what an officer should be. He talks a lot about the Rickover effect of the 1960s and 70s. So I just started pulling a thread and kept going back in time, and it landed in the 1870s, and that's where I started.
Well, let me ask you a question about the title, because progressives these days may have a different political meaning than it might have had in the time period you were writing about. Can you kind of make a distinction, or is there a distinction between what we now politically think of as progressives and what you were driving toward?
Absolutely. Yeah, I call this small p progressivism. It's progressivism before it became a political movement. You know, that really is a manifestation. The political progressivism is something that appeared in the early 1900s. But underpinning that was a methodology or a way of thinking, an ideology that scholars basically call the progressive methodology. And there are really three components to that. And that is, and this is approach to problem solving, social problems, political problems, technical problems. It's an approach that uses first a professionalized experts who have been trained, educated, vetted, and credentialed to do what they do. So professional experts is one element. The second is use of the scientific method. And this isn't so much the hypothesis and gathering evidence to prove or disprove the hypothesis, but it's more like what we call today basically critical thinking. Having habits of mind like the ability to adapt and adjust to changing situations, continuous improvement, all these habits roots in the later years of the 19th century. And then another element was cooperative problem solving, where teams of people will get together, they talk about issues, they talk about problems, and together they kind of hammer out some answers. And then finally, this idea of efficiency: how do we continue to make our activities more efficient and produce better outcomes with less effort? So that methodology or that ideology underpinned. And it was new. This was new in the late 19th century. It's something that kind of emerged during the Gilded Age, and it was adopted by various professions. Engineers, railroad engineers were among the first. Naval officers were an early adapter. And then later on, we see things like doctors and lawyers and city planners, and it just proliferates in the early 20th century. and gives rise to the progressive movement, which sought to employ these methods to solve social problems. Think New Deal, FDR New Deal. That was very much based on this methodology that I just described. But we're going back way before that, before it becomes politicized, and it was just kind of cutting edge of intellectual development in the Gilded Age.
And that kind of builds on something you mentioned a few minutes ago that really caught my attention as I was looking over the book. And when I read it, I went, we're still having that argument today. And that was that transition from that mariner warrior culture to what you define as the warrior engineer. And you can see that in the discussions we have right now about a technical bias, what type of education a naval officer has. Talk a little bit about the decisions and the frictions that was involved moving from a requirements of a mariner warrior culture that we saw prior to this area to the warrior engineer culture that responded to the great changes in technology.
Sure. And just dropping back to a question you asked earlier, what new things did I discover? One of them was that the fact that this debate between kind of a STEM education and a more holistic education has been going on since, you know, for over 100 years now. You know, I always thought it was just something, when I went through the Naval Academy, we had the famous 80-20 split, 80% technical majors and 20% bull or humanities. And really that debate's been going on for generations. It's not new. It's not something that we just saw within our lifetime. And so it got really interesting back in the 19th century because, well, some of the previous research on this era kind of depicts kind of one of the tensions going on within the Navy is these new progressive officers versus this reactionary old guard that was blocking change. And, you know, that may have been true up until the early 1870s, but after that, what I found was that there weren't too many of the old guard left, or those who were left had converted kind of to this newer idea that we need to, you know, they're getting on board the idea we need to change, that the world is changing, technology is changing, we need to change the way we think, we need to change the way we structure our careers, the way we train and educate and fight. And so by the 1880s, what was happening wasn't so much this old guard versus young Turk dichotomy, but you had different groups that all of which embraced this progressive methodology in different ways. And so they're actually competing. They have differing visions, but in a lot of ways they're overlapping visions of where the Navy should go. And so they fall out kind of in a, for ease of understanding, they fall out into two groups. One were kind of what I call mechanists, and these were what we would call today technocrats. And they were really interested in understanding technology, building technology, and operating technology and maintaining it. And obviously a STEM education was a big part of how they thought the officer corps should be formed. So we had the mechanists. And the reason I use the word mechanist, because that's the word they used back then. They didn't use the word technocrat, or you hardly ever see the word technology. They used the word mechanism. And so I call them mechanists because that's what they would have called themselves, maybe. The other group I call strategists. And they have the more holistic perspective. The questions they're asking are, how do we use this new technology, not so much how we build and operate it, but how do we use it tactically, strategically? How do we use it to fight and win wars? How do we use it to, you know, meet foreign policy goals and that sort of thing? So it was a much wider perspective. And, of course, everyone's heard of Mahan. Well, Alfred Thayer Mahan was probably the primary voice for that type of approach during the 1880s and 1890s, but he was also another important voice was Stephen Luce, who was Mahan's mentor. And so these officers kind of fell out in one or the other, but many of them actually straddled both worlds, and they advocated moving ahead with both ideas. So it was really interesting. It's not a black and white thing. It was very gray. But when it came down to competing for scarce resources, and this was an era of budget shortfalls and personnel cuts and that sort of thing, when it came to competing for resources, people's primary loyalty would often rise to the top. And so what we'd have was these groups that were oriented towards mechanism fighting against groups that were more strategically oriented for a piece of the Navy budget, for a piece of the pie. And so that created this very interesting tension that, which I didn't expect, but I discovered through the research, that this tension between these two groups going forward. And I think that explains a lot of what's going on today, because we still have, you know, similar perspectives today that are vying for resources.
Now, Scott, we have a caller on the line. Jerry Hendricks has a question for you. Jerry, you are live with Scott.
Hey, Scott.
Hello, Jerry.
Compliments on your book. Hi. I had a question about how the system, and by that what we would think is the Bureau personnel, dealt with what we would term the system integrators. So the people who moved beyond sort of the Isherwoods in the engine room to people ultimately like Sims and Fisk, and then even ultimately Spruance later in the 20th century, who actually began to integrate all these things and use the ships as a fighting system. How were they able to thread the career hurdles while still being somewhat known as these technologists or mechanicists, as you might term them?
Right. So I'm thinking of two aspects of this. One is the personnel system of the Navy. And at that point, the personnel assignments were done by the Bureau of Navigation. So the chief of navigation controlled all that. And the rise and fall of priorities really depended on who was in charge. So it just so happened during much of the 1880s, there was this guy named James Grimes Walker was the chief of navigation, and he was very much an integrator in the progressive vein. And he actually, one of the things that happened back in those days is that there were too many officers, so they put people on half pay, basically on sabbatical, and they'd go off and do things. Sometimes they'd go to school, get educated. So that's what Fisk did. Sometimes they would go and travel in Europe, usually to gather information about other navies. And sometimes they would go work in private industry, and Walker did that. He worked in the railroad industry, as an executive, and he did this a couple of times. So he comes back into the Navy on active duty with this experience, and at the time, the railroad industry was considered the most progressive, small-p progressive. It was a pioneering industry in terms of adapting progressive management methods. So this guy's there running the Bureau of Navigation. He's the guy who helped to give O&I legs. He helped to give the Naval War College legs. He mentored the people like Mahan and the guys who founded O&I and all that. And then that was one of the things that obviously he's assigning officers that go to the Naval War College. He's assigning bright young officers to go to O&I, where these are considered career-enhancing billets in his day. And then you could compare that to his successor, a guy named Francis Ramsey. Ramsey was very much a technologist guy, and he was a mechanist, and he didn't like the approach that Luce and Mahan were advocating or were affecting, they're accomplishing. So he would throw up roadblocks. There were several years that the War College had no attendees. He'd come up with reasons why they couldn't go. At one point he basically convinced his political allies in Congress to do away with the school. And so maybe later on I can tell that story of how it was saved at the last minute. But Ramsey privileged the technology side. So on his watch, the officers that were into technology really had a leg up, at least for a while. So then we get, you know, moving into the early 20th century, we get guys like Prince Chadwick and Bradley Fisk. You know, Fisk at the epitome. He actually embraced both worlds, both the strategy and the technology side. And he was a strong voice for both. He was actually a leading naval engineer. Electrical engineer. He basically went and did an apprenticeship in electrical engineering. So, and then he became also a leading strategist and an advocate for the Naval War College. So I think, in a roundabout way, Jerry, I'm getting to the answer here, that I think that the career paths were much more fluid back then, not unlike what we saw with a later generation with guys like Ernie King and Nimitz and those guys, where because things were, there's such a turn going on in terms of the institution, in terms of technology, in terms of strategy and tactics, that there was room here for people to make a name for themselves in any number of ways. And so we saw people going the technology route. We saw people going the strategy route, and a lot of people kind of doing both and you know, achieving higher rank and career success.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, one of the questions I had is, I think you covered it pretty well in the introduction, but there was in addition to the shift from warrior, there was also a shift in what strategy was. Can you kind of discuss how strategy was evolving at the same time?
Right. So I was reading the other day, I was reading the 2018 National Defense Strategy, and a phrase just leaped out at me. That's the phrase strategic atrophy. They use that in that document. And so if today we're coming off what some people call a period of strategic atrophy, I would say after the Civil War, we went into a period of strategic non-existence, like there was no strategy. And that was partly due to the way the profession regarded strategy up to this point in time. And so really from the origin, the founding of the Navy up until, you know, this Gilded Age period, the Navy profession did not we give much value to the idea of strategy and strategy making. It just wasn't important. And part of this too is the way the politicians, the political leadership also looked at it this way, that if we need a strategy because we have a war, well, we're perfectly capable of making it up when the war happens. We don't need to think about it in advance. So, and we saw this in the Civil War. It was shortly after Fort Sumter, the Lincoln administration formed a strategy board that basically hammered out the naval dimensions of the Anaconda Plan. They called it the blockade board. So they came up with the strategy for, or the way to carry out the blockade strategy, and the idea of going up the Mississippi River and cutting the South in half that way. They kind of did the broad outlines of that, and then they disbanded. So by this was in 1861. So by the fall of 1861, there is no longer a strategy board. And really, the strategy makers were Secretary Wells and probably more Gustavus Fox, the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, also a former naval officer. He was the real driver of that, and obviously they're consulting with the senior leadership, the uniform leadership of the Navy, in doing that. But once the war ends, they disbanded that. They disestablished that office, and we go back to basically strategy being something that is just not important to us. I came across a document, just by way of evidence, I came across a document in my research from the 1850s, I think it was, and it was some relatively junior officers writing the Secretary of the Navy with a proposal for a way to create an offshore strategy to defend the United States in the event of war, instead of a at-the-waterline strategy. The forts and frigates basically, you know, will defend the nation by commerce raiding and by fixed fortifications in our key harbors. He said, well, we can carry the fight to the enemy on the high seas. Anyway, that's a proposal, and you could read the inscription that basically the SECNAV sent this to his senior leaders, uniform leaders, and they basically said, this is a waste of time. You guys need to go back to work and just not worry about this stuff, this strategy stuff. I'm paraphrasing, but that's basically what they told them. So the Navy did not value strategy. The Navy as an institution, as a profession, didn't value strategy going into the 1870s. And so what happened then is due to a number of reasons, the naval profession, the officer corps, began to become interested in this on their own. So the thing I call the strategical awakening of the 1870s and 80s, they began to talk about strategy. They began to try to understand it better, and they began to write about it and talk about it. And so in ways that they had not before. You can trace how this thing starts through the 1870s, and by the 1880s, it's getting some momentum. So with that, we're leading into the time when some of these thinkers managed to convince the Navy civilian leadership to establish some institutions where you can look at strategy and start making strategy and thinking about strategy and during peacetime, which was unprecedented. Like I said before, it was an ad hoc, improvised thing that you did when the war after the war started, but now they're starting to think about it in peacetime. And so that was a big change. That was a major paradigm shift, and it was resisted by many naval officers, but there was a critical mass, I think, in time that managed to sustain it. And then once we see institutions like the Naval War College and ONI, Office of Naval Intelligence, they actually had a home where they could delve into this more deeply.
One of the questions You talked about it a second ago. You touched on it. What was the controversy over the existence of the Naval War College?
Well, it's kind of complicated. You know, basically, as a lot of people know, the Naval War College was the brainchild of Stephen B. Luce. He's the one that convinced the Secretary of the Navy against the advice of the Secretary's other advisors to form a panel to study what kind of advanced education would be good for naval officers, because up till now there was no postgraduate program. Your formal schooling ended when you left the Naval Academy. And so Luce thought there was more to it than that. He was a part of the strategical awakening that I referred to. And so he's got all these questions about strategy. There's this great moment in his memoirs where he talks about he was CO of a ship that was stationed on I think it's Savannah River between Georgia and South Carolina, and so he's on that river and he is charged with covering the crossing of Sherman's army from Georgia into South Carolina. So this is towards the end of the war. And he had these discussions with Sherman. He met with Sherman, and he's talking with him. And Sherman says, well, Luce, look at this. You Navy guys have been trying to crack into Charleston now for the entire war, which was true. And you have failed. Trying to get in there from the sea was a failure. And he said, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do this within the next couple of weeks. And Charleston's not going to fire a shot, and that's what happened. You know, he marched to the capital of South Carolina, took that, and then so Charleston surrendered because they were cut off. And Luce says, when that happened, the scales fell from my eyes, and I realized that these ideas of strategy and you know, logistics and operations were things that would be well worth the naval professional to study. So he says that he realized that. And so he, he took, that was his takeaway from the war, and he nurtured it over the next couple of decades. And then he tried to interest the Navy leadership in the late 1870s in the idea of the War College. Keep in mind, the Army has already had some advanced schools of practice, like the artillery school and the infantry school. So he's looking at those. He visited those. He's talking to the people that are running those. He thinks the Navy needs to have this too. He's unable to convince his superiors in the 1870s, but he comes back again in the 1880s after Congress has started to appropriate to build basically new steel ships to replace the aging wooden ships from the Civil War era. So he sees an opportunity here with the new administration and kind of this new momentum. So he pitches it to the Secretary of the Navy, William Chandler, who says, yeah, go ahead and form a committee to study this. And so they do that, and the committee comes back and says, yeah, we should do this War College. And it's a very interesting report that they produced about basically saying we need to create adaptive combat leaders who understand strategy and understand the art and science of war in a much deeper way than we do now, and which is interesting to me, because if you see what's going on with naval education reform now, it's some of the same ideas are kicking around with that they were dealing with back in, you know, the mid-1880s. So Luce convinces the SECNAV, or the board recommends creating the Naval War College. SECNAV likes it. So it comes into being. Luce is the first president of the War College. He gets the first class through. And then, meanwhile, Mahan comes in 1885-86, and Luce gets transferred out. So Mahan becomes the president, and that begins the beginning of Mahan's experience at Naval College. His lectures, as many people know, became his first book, The Influence of Sea Power Upon History. And the rest is fairly, most Navy professionals today know a little bit about what Mahan did afterwards and his influence. So that comes in, you know, he takes over the War College. Administrations change, and due to some personality conflicts, perhaps, and some partisan political considerations, it doesn't fare so well under the next administration, who basically postures to minimize the War College, and hopefully there's perhaps have it just go away, just fade away. So they move the War College from its own independent institution. They put it under the command of what's called the Torpedo School, which was actually was created back in around 1869, so it predates the War College. And it was pretty much a technical school, and, you know, part of its mission was to develop torpedo technology, which seemed very promising coming out of the Civil War. Both sides used torpedoes. You know, the Hunley, its attack on the Housatonic was a torpedo. The William Cushing sank the Confederate ironclad Albemarle with a patrol boat, a small steam patrol boat with a spar torpedo, just like the Hunley. So that was kind of a famous event at the time, and people took notice both in the U.S. and abroad, and began to develop this idea of this cheap, very powerful weapon that could take out capital ships. And so the U.S. Navy, Congress appropriates and creates the Torpedo School, and so that was kind of a center of this mechanistic technological perspective for many years. And so now what we see in the late 1880s is that the Naval War College under Secretary Whitney gets moved from its own schoolhouse there in Coasters Harbor over to Goat Island, where the Torpedo School is, and comes under that command. So it's kind of subordinated. And but it just so happened that the commanding officer of the Torpedo School was very much a fan of the Naval War College, and he valued it. And he, in fact, was a member of Luce's original board that recommended establishing it. So his name was Caspar Goodrich. So Goodrich takes it upon himself as his mission to keep the school alive. So he does. And then a new administration comes in after that, which for a number of reasons, including partisan politics and just, you know, strategic sense, elevates the War College once again, gives it independence, and eventually the Torpedo School is subordinated to the War College. So that continues on, and then there's another administration shift. The War College is doing well, but the new Secretary of the Navy under the second Coolidge administration, a guy named Hillary Herbert, is a longstanding enemy of the War College, and he plans to shut it down. He goes up there to shut it down on a tour of inspection that will end up shutting it down. That was his intention. He even talks about this in his memoirs, and he confessed this in a speech he gave to the Naval War College a few years later, that I was going to shut this place down. But once he got there, he saw what the War College was doing. By now, the president is Taylor, Captain Taylor, and he sees that they're doing is really good work. So he changes his mind, and he actually makes the War College kind of an informal general staff that he relies on for strategic planning, because by this point in time, strategic planning has taken off, and we're seeing a number of different centers of planning within the Navy, at ONI, at the War College, in the fleet. They're all involved with strategic planning now, and we're seeing the first, some of the first actual written contingency plans start to appear during these days. So, but once Herbert gave the War College's blessing, and that was around 1894, maybe 1895. Once that happened, it disarmed the opponents of the War College, and so from then on, it was on pretty firm footing. Pretty firm footing. So, kind of this strategical ethos, this holistic ethos, won the day at least temporarily, and certainly there was no longer any existential threat to the War College. That's kind of a long description of what's going on, the trials and tribulations of the Naval War College. So it wasn't a sure thing. You know, Lee came up with the idea, but it could have been shut down at any number of points, a number of times in that first decade due to a number of different reasons. And it just worked out, you know, historical contingency. You never really know what's going to happen. In the end, it wasn't. And so it's still there today.
Yeah. I have to tell you that Sal, for some reason, had to take off, so you're stuck with me alone for the rest of the show.
No worries.
Poor fellow. One of the other things that interested me was you talked about the way that the focus of what the American Navy was for kept shifting. It went from, let's say, coastal defense to maritime support of the maritime industry. Could you kind of run through that and why the importance of that in the establishment of the strategic thought of the time?
Sure. Well, just a brief historical overview, going way back to the beginning of the Navy. Originally, the Navy pretty much envisioned as a force for coastal defense and for protecting U.S. interests abroad, particularly commercial interests, during peacetime. And then coastal defense, a coastal defense strategy during wartime, coupled with commerce trading on the high seas. The enemy of choice was always Britain. That's who we thought we'd have to fight, and maybe France. We fought both of them, as you know, early in the early days of the Republic. And so that model kind of stuck. But as time goes on, you know, after the War of 1812, the U.S. is largely at peace in the 1820s and 30s. There's little skirmishes here and there, but no actual large war. And in the meantime, the Industrial Revolution just takes off in the U.S. In the 1840s, it just skyrocks. You know, GDP skyrockets, and so does foreign trade. It takes off. So the Navy begins to become more active as the U.S. merchant fleet, which became the second largest merchant fleet in the world behind that of Great Britain. They're all over the world. They're far flung in large numbers. and you know, we need to protect these sailors and these ships, because occasionally there are issues, violence, they encounter violence in some places for any number of reasons. Sometimes it's their own fault, sometimes it's not. But the Navy says, hey, well, we need to get out there and we need to protect this. And so this becomes the Navy's new mission. It becomes very much not so much defense policy as driving the size and composition and culture of the Navy, but this peacetime commercial mission. And this comes to be viewed as the normal mission of the Navy by both political leadership and by Navy professionals. So these mariner warriors in this time period grow up in this peacetime commercial Navy, which is essentially a constabulary force stationed all over the world. It's not particularly big. It's about 40 ships, 40 active duty ships at any one time. There's brief moments where the paradigm shifts because we go to war. We have the war with Mexico in the 1840s. And then, of course, the Civil War is a major change in focus there. But after those wars end, we always go back to this peacetime paradigm, this peace paradigm, what's called the Peace Navy. They called it that back then. And that's what I use in the book. That's the Peace Navy, which is being driven by commercial policy, not national security policy. So, and that's what we have going into the 1880s. But so what's going on during the last decades of the 19th century is that we begin to see a growing concern for national defense. And this is driven by two factors. One is the rise in technology, or the advances in technology that foreign navies are starting to instigate. And there's a perception of a technology gap between the U.S. Navy and these foreign navies, which was somewhat justified. The U.S. Navy comes out of the Civil War as kind of the arguably the nation's or the world's preeminent navy. And, you know, we had the most advanced technology. We had a huge fleet, almost 700 ships. Even the British were a little bit worried by the strength of our navy. But as we return to that peacetime role, that commercial role, that navy gets disbanded. And by the early 1870s, we're back down to about 40 ships, which was the pre-war norm for a constabulary force. And in the same time, there are a number of reasons, again, both the civilian leadership and Navy professionals, many of them don't see any point in technological development, partly because it's expensive, partly because there's a lot of uncertainty about what direction the technology is going to take, and we don't want to waste time and money on things that are dead ends. And partly there's just political philosophy in the U.S. that we don't want a strong Navy or Army, and we'll maintain a minimum peacetime establishment, so you don't need to. We're going to spend as little money as we need to take care of the peacetime missions, which, to be honest, the Civil War sloops of war, wooden sloops of war with smoothbore cannons were pretty effective in that peacetime mission. They're not going up against first world navies. They're going against lesser powers that don't have the same technological advance as we have, even though ours is getting more and more obsolete. So it seemed fine. It seemed fine, and everything was good. But then in the 1870s, part of the strategical awakening that I referred to a few minutes ago was this idea that, you know, Navy professionals began to realize that the technology overseas was far surpassing that of the U.S., and they became worried about it. And that's one of the factors that caused them to think about strategy more. And so that kind of fed into this. And the other part was, so that was the technological advances began to worry naval officers. And then the other thing we saw was the unraveling of the European great power system and the rise of neocolonialism throughout the world. And as Europe and other European nations and others you know, think Japan, think Russia, and think the United States began to have imperial designs overseas, we began to worry that as we were expanding our role, this commercial, it wasn't really a true empire, but it was this commercial pseudo-empire that we're looking to expand, and we had been since the 1840s, our commercial relationships around the world, that we would come into conflict with one of these great powers that was expanding into an area that we thought where we were trying to open markets and establish trade. So that was going on too, and the world is becoming more unsettled, more unstable, more uncertain, and so the Navy professionals sensed that and began to become concerned. So that gives rise to what I call the strategical awakening of the 1870s, early 80s. But by the 1880s, what's happening is that they're managing, that political leaders are beginning to feel the same concerns, partly on their own, partly because they're reading some of the stuff that these naval officers are writing. And sometimes there's a mix of motivations here, but the general consensus is that the U.S. is becoming more vulnerable in this unraveling world, and we need to update the Navy, and we need to strengthen it, and we need to focus more on national defense, on the defense of our maritime frontiers, than on this commercial mission. So in the mid-1880s, there's a shift, and the moment happens when Secretary of the Navy William Whitney basically says, okay, we need a Navy that can fight other fleets. We need a Navy that can defend our nation. And he testifies to Congress in early 1886 saying this. And so we see this, that basically marks the mission shift, where we're moving away from this commercial model, you know, commercial constabulary model to a national defense, you know, maritime frontier defense model, which was a departure from the historical trend at that time. So this departure takes place mid-1880s. At the same moment, the Naval War College has basically come into existence and begins its struggles. The Office of Naval Intelligence is established. Strategy begins to be practiced by naval officers in these new institutions. One of the things I found in my research was the earlier surviving actual written contingency plan, which was created under ONI auspices in 1887. And it was really, as a historian, that was really fun, you know, a cool thing to happen, that I found this buried deep within the archives at the Naval War College in a place you'd never expect it, because other scholars, you know, previous scholars had speculated about this document, but no one had ever seen it. And there it was hiding in plain sight. So I found it, wrote an article about that in the International Journal of Naval History, and that's in the book too. That was kind of a neat thing. But so the late 1880s, we're starting to see written contingency plans, and it really takes off in the mid-1890s. And it's supporting this Navy that's not really an imperial Navy anymore. It's not supporting this commercial empire. It's supporting national defense.
I thought that was kind of an interesting. You kind of stood some other historians on their heads, if you will, by pointing out that the U.S. Navy wasn't developed to be an imperialist Navy in the sense that a lot of these people were arguing, but was being honed to be a national defense force. If I read
right,
that correctly,
right. That's exactly right. And thank you for saying that, because I'm glad that you were able to pick that up from the book, because that was kind of a major point of the book, and it's something that I kind of came across by accident. I wasn't expecting this to be there, and in fact, you know, in the title it says American Maritime Strategy, American Empire, etc. Well, that American Empire became part of the title, part of the book, because I found this thing I wasn't expecting, that the Navy was stepped by the political leadership, stepped away from this quasi-imperial mission, the commercial mission, and it was focusing more on national defense. And other historians have interpreted this differently. basically arguing that the Navy that was came into being, the new Navy of the 1880s and 1890s, was the protogenitor of the Great White Fleet. It was created to conquer and maintain an empire. And I say, no, it wasn't. If you look at the congressional debates, there are imperialist voices in there, but they're relatively muted. And it's clear to me the consensus in Congress, in so much as Congress reflects the American people, was no, we don't want a Navy for empire. We need to defend ourselves. And those votes from the opposition party that, you know, and the party in power that consistently voted in, you know, naval appropriations from about 1885 on, at least up until the eve of the War of 1898, they're really thinking we're doing this for national defense. Now, just so happened this National Defense Navy worked fine in defeating an aged, declining navy of a former great power, Spain. But that wasn't what people were – that was not the intent of most people. I mean, sure, we had Teddy Roosevelt and Henry Cabot Lodge and those guys, the imperialists, they were voices at this time. They were casting votes in Congress when they were in Congress for a navy, and they certainly saw the navy as – that was their vision, but that was not the majority vision. The Congress and the American people really saw this navy as being a defensive tool, not an imperial tool, and that surprised me when I saw that. So there was maybe a 15-year period in there where there's kind of a change in direction historically to this imperial theme that hasn't been addressed before, and so now I kind of added that to the literature, and we'll see if other people agree or disagree with that. But that's so the Navy's mission's changed from commercial imperial to self-defense, and then after the War of 1898. It becomes a more overt imperial force, arguably by accident. Certainly the Navy wasn't configured for imperial duties, and they had to very quickly after the war, after the U.S. acquired the Philippines and various other territories around the world from Spain, the Navy had to quickly reconfigure because they didn't have the right kind of ships. They didn't have if you look at the numbers, we were very deficient in gunboats, which were really the ideal type of ship for imperial duty. And we were also deficient in basically combat logistics. We didn't have a logistics force up until that moment because the force, this 40-ship Navy that was overseas for commercial duties, they could get all their logistics locally, and we weren't worried about we didn't have a great power stake anywhere where all of a sudden the people in the port where the ships were docking or anchoring wouldn't sell them their material because we had no enemies. But now as an imperial power, conceivably we couldn't have that. So we had to have a logistics force, which was the birth of combat logistics. We were talking about that before the show. It's the birth of that. The combat logistics force was really in the wake of the War of 1898.
Yeah, one of the other things I thought you pointed out pretty well was that the Navy was leading the country in this small P progressive, innovative, effort. And and a lot of this, I mean, I put down early on in my notes on what I was making in this book, early globalists. I mean, Is the reason for that the Navy guys were out seeing what was happening in the world more, and that drove them to do the things that they did? Was it the experience on the abroad and by examining other navies that were really the driving, or at least a big part of the driving force of this?
Well, I think if you go back and look at the history of the Navy. And what it was doing. And there's a study, a CNA study that Peter Schwartz authored some time ago. He steps through the Navy's deployment patterns from the 1890s or 1790s when the Navy was reestablished after the Revolution. He's looking at deployment patterns, and you can see very much that the Navy has always been a global force. And I think to a certain extent, naval officers and Navy professionals have had a more of a global outlook than many of the folks back home, just because that's where they spent a lot of their lives, their professional lives. Now, that said, you know, we see in the late 19th century, some people call this the first wave of globalization, where due to technological improvements and the expansion of economies, of national economies throughout the world, we're starting to see this greater connectedness between peoples around the world. And certainly the Navy has a role here, and I think that perspective was very natural for naval officers going into this. And I think to a certain extent, this, you know, they picked up on the globalizing trend, both the positive and negative things that are happening, and that's what's going on in the 1870s and 80s when these naval officers are starting to think about strategy. And in many ways, that whole intellectual development in turn was a response to globalization. So they're very attuned to that. So, yeah, I think they were very attuned to that, but I think they always had been.
Yeah, other question. Who were the political leaders who helped drive the progress of the Navy in parallel with what the uniformed people were up to?
Sure. Well, I think there were two centers of political leadership that helped to, helped to bring about these changes. And one of them, of course, is the Office of the Secretary of the Navy. And then after 1889, we now had a permanent assistant secretary. Today, that's the undersecretary. Tom Maudsley is the latest person to fill that office. But so those leaders really played a key role. And we began to see the Navy was lucky in that from about 1880 on, we began to see a series of capable administrators in the Office of Secretary of the Navy. Before then, it had been mostly political cronies of the president or party hacks and stuff. But I think for whatever reason, well, I think partly because of these trends in technology and international affairs, maybe the presidents were starting to pay more attention to who's leading at the Navy Department. So these guys that they put into office were actually pretty capable. So the SECNAV was a pivotal leader in all this. And the other part of this was Congress. Certainly the House and Senate Naval Affairs Committees played influential roles, because they would steer, you know, they'd vet all these proposals for naval increasing the size of the Navy and the technology choices and organizing new institutions like the War College and ONI. Although it's interesting, the War College didn't exist with the congressional budget line probably for the first 5 or 6 years of its existence. It was just coming out of Hyde. I mean, the Naval Department had to find money to support the place. And there's this kind of this famous story where Mahan, he has no money, so he starts selling excess furniture and stuff to buy coal to keep the place warm in the wintertime. So it kind of gives these idea of budget shortfalls a new perspective when you read that story. But and actually, he talks about that in his memoir, so it's, you know, we know it happened. But But there's Congress is really important. There's certain key members of Congress, and I could name names if you're interested. Played a role in this. But I think also, I think that the Navy professionals did a pretty good job, you know, understanding the importance of the civil leadership, the role they played, and building and leveraging the relationships that they had. And it's interesting, earlier in the show, we talked about the competition between the mechanists and the strategists, between the the STEM guys and the holistic guys, and each of them had their own constituency in Congress. They built up these relationships, and so what was going on within the Navy in terms of the debates and conflicts played out on the floors of Congress as well. And so that's part of the story in the book, is how that happened. And without the political leadership, nothing could have happened. Without the civil leaders, nothing could have happened. I think a takeaway for us today in that is that, you know, this engagement, this close engagement between the uniformed progressives, the uniformed reformers, and the civil leadership was really key to moving ahead with these ideas of innovation. And, you know, what it started out as a bottom-up initiative, in my opinion. It started up with the research shows me it was a bottom-up initiative engendered within the profession. You know, these ideas for innovation came from within the Navy, but when they wanted to move out and act on these, they had to partner with the civilian leadership, both Congress, congressional, and executive, and start making some headway on making these innovations a reality.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point and a good place to stop so we can give you back your Sunday afternoon. Let me thank you for appearing, and let me tell people about the book. It's Progressive and Navy Blue. It's available on Amazon and at the USNI Press. As you may gather from the conversation we've had here with Scott Mobley, the author of the book, he's excited about it, and it comes through in the writing. I think it's a really interesting read, and commend it to you. And Scott, for you, tell us in a couple of whatever time you want to take to what you're up to next, and what can we look forward to from you in the near future?
Well, there's a couple of projects that I'm mulling over. I just started my new position at University of Wisconsin, so that's my main focus right now. But one of the ideas I'm thinking about is doing something along the, are you familiar with the 21st Century series from the Naval Institute?
Oh, yeah.
The 21st Century in the Hand and various others. So I'm thinking about, you know, maybe a 21st Century Loose as an entry into that or something like that. Maybe not with that series, but something to that, you know, that along similar lines. So that's one possible project. And the other project is I'm looking at William Leahy, the first chairman of the Joint Chiefs, who, you know, the first five-star in U.S. history, first five-star flag officer, and kind of an underrated historical personality, you know, perhaps with rightfully so, and perhaps not. So what I'm thinking of is taking a fresh look at him, and in particular his role at CNO during the late 1930s, and looking at that as a study in civil-military relations, because he had a fairly close relationship with FDR. They'd known each other for decades, and just to kind of unpack that whole relationship and see if there's anything to learn there that might be helpful today, you know, in terms of civil-military relations.
Well, that sounds pretty interesting. Keep us posted on your work, and let us know how things are going. We'd love to have you back on the show. Appreciate you taking the time to be with us this afternoon, and best of luck with this book, because it's an interesting read.
Well, thanks. I appreciate being here.
All right. Well, we'll let you go back to your family and all that good stuff. Thanks a lot again, and I'm going to practice trying to shut this program down, because I rarely ever get the opportunity to do this. So thanks again. We'll talk to you, I'm sure, again in the future.
Sure thing. Take care.
Bye.
Piccadilly for you.